رسول الكريم
وعلى آله وأصحابه ومن
استنى بسنته إلى يوم الدين. Our praise is due to Allah, may Allah's peace and blessings be on His last Prophet Muhammad صلى الله عليه وسلم
and on all those who follow the path of righteousness
until the last day.
Before we get into questions, as you're thinking about what questions you'd like to ask,
and actually it would have been better if you had made a list of questions from home and brought them here with you, you know,
rather than trying to remember what questions you want to ask it at the spur of the moment.
I just give a
few words as you're putting your ideas together. That, alhamdulillah, you know, Allah has blessed you with a consciousness of Islam, whatever degree it may be. And it's something that if from your youth you are able to develop Islamically throughout your youth and into your, you know, later years,
then it only makes,
of course, your later years
that much better.
Ultimately, we are here for a short period of time, and our purpose ultimately is to worship Allah. Although at the age that you are, there seems to be a lot more things important to you than worshiping Allah, the fact of the matter is that most of these things which tend to take your attention or grab your enthusiasm are things which you will do for a period of time and then you'll get tired of doing them and you'll go on to other things. But you have to make sure that there is a part of yourself which is not going to change, which will continue to be throughout your whole life. And it is going to determine whether whatever you engage in, whatever activities you are involved in, whether these ultimately will benefit you or not. And that, of course, is Islam. I mean, this is what is supposed to make you different from the other members of the society. Though you might feel that the best thing for yourself is to blend in and to be like everybody else, nobody knows you as being any different, the fact of the matter is that you are different. You are different. There is a different goal that you have from the other members of the society. And fundamentally, you should be Muslims first. Whether you're a Muslim student in high school or you're a Muslim student in university or college, you should be Muslim first. You shouldn't be a student who happens to be a Muslim. Student who happens to be a Muslim, he could have been a Christian or a Jew or an atheist, and it wouldn't make any difference. It's all the same. But the fact of the matter is that you are Muslims first, and you should be. That should be reflected in your way of thinking, in the way in which you carry yourself, in your character. Because Islam is primarily character. It's not necessarily how much Quran you have memorized, how many hadiths you know, but how your character is in relationship to the teachings of Islam. Because all of the various principles of Islam are geared towards developing a particular type of character. Though the salah or the fasting are things that we do on a regular basis that we might think are more ritual, that we do it because our parents say to do it, etc. The goal of the salah really is to make us better people. And in any society, ultimately, those people who are admired, those people who are held in high esteem, are the people who are the good people of the society. In the end, I mean, no matter how popular certain individuals may be at one time or another, ultimately those who the society as a whole admire are those people who were good people, who after they die, when people write stories about them, you will not find, you know, stories that are terrible.
And when they were alive, nobody knew what they were actually doing. But after they die, then you find people writing stories about them, and you find actually their lives are very corrupt. For example, JFK, you know, Kennedy, and his wife. While they were alive, I mean, they were, you know, the classical example of a wonderful family. JFK was the president of the United States of America. But now you read the books that they're writing about him now. Him and his wife, Jacqueline Onassis, right? Kennedy. They were involved in drugs and adultery and, you know, all kinds of wild. Their lives were corrupt. So they were fundamentally, though, on the outside, they were, you know, well-liked, etc., etc., and they did stand, JFK stood for some good principles. Fundamentally, they were not good people. They were not good people, and history will expose them. And this will bring them down in the eyes of the mass of the people. So ultimately, the good people are those who are good, not only externally, as on the exterior, but who are good both externally and internally. Well, how can a person be good internally if he fears God? Because as long as a person feels that he or she is not responsible, nobody knows what they're doing, then the temptation is to do what they shouldn't do. So it is only with the consciousness of God that a person now will never feel nobody knows. Allah knows. Allah always knows. So it is something you can't escape. As a Muslim, then, you cannot feel any circumstance that you're all alone and nobody knows what's going on. So because of that, then you will judge and question any kind of action you're going to do. As a young person, when you're going out with your friends or in school, and you have homework to do, you have tests to prepare for, whatever, whenever you're doing these things, it should be done with a consciousness that Allah is aware of what you're doing. If you have homework to do, you try to do it to the best of your ability. Because Prophet Muhammad said, "Inna Allah yuhibbu min ahadikum idha amila amalan yutqina." That Allah loves from each and every one of you. If you do something, you do it to the best of your ability. You don't plot and plan, "Well, you know, I have a friend who's good at this, so I'm going to copy his notes afterwards. You know, I'll just copy his notes." No. Because though you might fool the teacher, you cannot fool Allah. You can't fool Allah. And your copying of the notes is only harming you. In the end, your copying of notes is only harming you. This is why Allah refers to sins as being self-oppression. You know, those who oppress themselves. Because in the end, you hurt yourself by not doing homework, by cheating, you know. All of the negative practices that students, young people get involved in, all of these things ultimately hurt themselves. Because you can't hurt Allah. We might hurt other people also, and in the end, it will come back to hurt us on the Day of Judgment. So very important that we make use of the time that Allah has given us, as young people, the youth that Allah has given us, that we don't destroy it, we don't waste it, use it to our own benefit. So having said that, just a few words now, inshallah. Any questions you'd like to ask regarding your situations or the deen, religion, anything? This is your time for the next hour. Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Okay, it's a good question. I mean, should the Muslim youth dress, as you said, quote-unquote, normal? Or are you supposed to, you know, wear something on your head and whatever? Well, in terms of beard, because you meant something on your head and a beard, if you're at the age where you're starting to grow a beard, then you should grow it. You shouldn't shave. Right? Because shaving is prohibited.
Prophet had told us to grow our beards and to trim our mustaches and distinguish ourselves from the pagans. So that is something compulsory, growing of the beard. Now, other than that, it is better to distinguish yourself from the others. Now that distinction could be by wearing some kind of cap on your head,
or it could be by not following the fashions, which you shouldn't do anyway.
You know, as a Muslim, you should not be fashionable, meaning that you change the fashions as the fashions change. You've got to be in with the fashion. Whichever way it goes, you're going. Right?
Because in the end, what that shows is that you have no personality. You're a robot. You know, you've been programmed by the media, and whatever they want you to do, you're just like a slave to that. You're, as they say, a slave to fashion. This is what you don't want to be. You want to be yourself. You want to have your own distinct personality. Right? In terms of your character, you can distinguish yourself, but in terms of dress, we'll continue with dress. The most important distinction should be really in character. This is where you should distinguish yourself. Meaning that when you're hanging out or you're with your friends at school, whatever, non-Muslims, and they're all swearing, every second word is a swear word about this and that, and they're cursing, and you don't. You will distinguish yourself by the fact that you don't engage in that. And you should advise them also not to do the same. And though they may think it makes them feel big or good or whatever, or tough or whatever, but in fact this is not being tough and big, you know. Anybody can do it. And when you look at this, the society as a whole, you see that those who speak like this, these are the dregs of the society. These are the lower elements of the society. People whose intelligence is limited, and the only way they can express themselves is by using curse words, you know, or by physical means, getting into fights, you know, any little thing they're ready to jump up and, you know. I mean, this is really a sign of low intelligence. It's not a sign of strength or courage or, you know, being hip or whatever, no. This is the reality. So, from the point of view of character, the Muslim should distinguish himself or herself from the others by way of their character. That they don't engage in the negative practices of the other youths. It doesn't mean that they isolate themselves to the point where they don't communicate with anybody else. They may move with them, but they're not sharing in all of the things that they do. What is negative, what is harmful, etc. Then they should avoid these things and encourage the others also to avoid them. But back in terms of the dress again, there are some principles of the Islamic dress code. One, that as Muslims we shouldn't wear garments which have pictures of animals and things like this, right? You know, pictures of animals, whether ancient or recent. Also, our garments should be, as males, the garments should be loose, not showing the region between the navel and the knee. This should not be described by the garment. If one wears the kind of garments that, under certain circumstances, do describe this area, then one should wear some kind of top which comes down and covers to the point of the knee. So that area is covered, because if you make salah, and when you go into sujood, the average person here, you know, wearing these kind of pants, when you go into sujood, you look at that person. Look at the person when they go into sujood. What's happening here? See what happens to your pants, etc. How it exposes your private parts. And you all know that one of the conditions for salah is that the awrah, or the private part between the navel and the knee, be covered. So according to some scholars, making salah in these kind of pants is not valid. You invalidate your salah by exposing your private parts, deliberately. So it's not something that it happened and you didn't know. See, if you were praying, you know, just accidentally your belt burst and your pants fell down, okay? You can pull it back up, you carry on your salah, it's okay, your salah is not broken, because this is something beyond your control. But now when you put on these pants, and you know, you look at all your friends when they bend over, then they're in sujood, and see what you see, you know clearly that's the same thing happening to yourself, and it means if you put on these pants and go and pray in them, you're deliberately wearing clothes which you know will expose your private parts in your prayer. So in that case, some scholars hold that prayer is not valid. At least the value of your prayer has been diminished. You know? Or we could say at best, you know, if we say, okay, your prayer isn't invalidated, for sure the value of the prayer will have been diminished. So, as I said, in terms of Islamic dress, it's not saying that you must wear shalwar and khamis, or thobe, but you should, your clothing, as males here, your clothing should conform to Islamic standards. That is, if you're wearing pants, they should either be very loose, so loose that when you go into sujood, when you bow for ruku', your private parts are not exposed, are not formed and shaped by your clothing. Or you wear a loose top. You're wearing a top which is so long, you know, that it comes down to cover that region. So when you bend, etc., you are covered. Either one or the other. Then the other principle, of course, is that the pant should be above the ankle. It should not, though the style now is to have it down, you know, hanging down below the ankle, and that is fashionable, etc. The Islamic code is above the ankle. And though when you, if you wear your pants above the ankle, you know, people may look at you, oh, look at this character, you know, he's out of style, he's not in style. But at the same time, it's you. If you think about it, if you're able to do that and not be fazed by the fact that the style is below the ankle, then you're a better person. You're a stronger person. You know, you have character. Now, if you're the type of person, if somebody sees you with your pants above the ankle, you know, they say something, oh, you feel so embarrassed and so what. Then it shows what kind of, you're a weak character. You know, you don't have personality. Your personality is very weak. And the person with a strong personality is one that they can stick by their principles. It doesn't faze them. You know? And the reality is, you know, as I've pointed out before, if next year the style becomes above the ankle, then guess what? Those of you that are wearing below the ankle will wear above the ankle. You know? So it just shows where you at, you know? It's not above the ankle, it's not an issue about wearing above the ankle. No, it's an issue about fashion, ultimately. Are you a slave to fashion? You know, do you worship the fashion designers? And when you look to see who is behind the fashion, right? You go and remove the, behind the curtain, see who's behind the curtain sending these people out on the stages with all these fashion. You see that they're a bunch of homosexual, you know, corrupt, sick individuals. These are the leaders of the fashion. And that's who represents now your prophets. That's what's happening. They've become your prophets. They're the ones telling you to wear this and you're going to wear that. Wear the other and you're going to wear that. You know? If next year they tell you to wear a bra on your head, you're going to wear a bra on your head. You know? You're going to be in fashion. This is the reality. And you have to decide for yourself, who are you? You know? Is that what you are? You're just a slave to these corrupt individuals who are in determining fashion? Or are you your own self, your own person, where you can decide for yourself where you want to be in life? So, in terms of the Islamic dress, we said Muslims, young people, should be distinct from non-Muslims. Not that you necessarily want to become like a clown. You know what I'm saying, that you're going to wear a clown suit, right? You know, which just really makes you stand out, you know. a big green turban and, you know, no, it's not Islam saying, if you want to wear a turban, of course, but I'm just saying that, you know, that you, Islam is not saying that you have to appear in that fashion. But the point is that whatever of dress that you wear, it should be in accordance with Islamic standards. It shouldn't have pictures, images. It shouldn't have symbols of the cross and things like this which are associated with other religions. And it should be above the ankles for males. It should not expose the private parts for both males and females. So, in terms of written questions here, can you please comment on the permissibility or impermissibility of rock music? Can you perhaps give us a personal example if you used to listen and how you stopped? Well, the fact of the matter is, I not only used to listen, I used to play. You know, I played rock music, different versions of it. In the 70s, I used to play in nightclubs. I played guitar and sang along with a group. And after becoming Muslim, actually nobody told me that it was haram. So I continued to play. I was playing in nightclubs in Toronto. I played in Malaysia, Vancouver. And after becoming a Muslim, in the nightclub, I found myself as if I were in a different world. You know, the other members of the group that I played in, they were all taking drugs. And in the nightclub, everybody is high on something. You know, and I'm the only one who is sane there, you see. And though physically speaking, I'm there playing along with everybody else, I'm observing the circumstance, and it became very clear to me how sick that circumstance was, and that there was no way I could really be a part of this. You know, it was just so far, in another world altogether than, you know, where I was. So by myself, I decided to stop. I sold all my equipment and my records and things, just got rid of it. But later on, I found out after study that, according to Islamic teachings, that music, rock music as we know it, wind and string instruments, are haram. And I knew that the effect that it has on people, you know, is a very strong effect, and that it is, it's overwhelming, and it is addictive. It is so strong that a person can recall at an instant, you know, any song that they heard 10 years ago, whatever, you know, the song is still there, complete, all the words, everything, you know, because it has sort of taken a spot in your heart, and it fills up the heart. And ultimately, when we read the Quran, we read the Sunnah, this also goes into our hearts. And both cannot coexist and occupy the same space. The more music you listen to, the less space that you have for spiritual matters, for the deen, for the Quran, for the Sunnah. And ultimately, the music, which a number of scholars refer to as the Quran of Shaitan, which it is, which occupies that space, it will displace the faith. It will displace the faith. It will overwhelm us eventually. We think that it's not affecting us. We're only listening to it while studying. It helps me study and all these other things. But the fact of the matter is that, see, the way the brain is, the way our systems are, that when you keep feeding data like this into the system, it starts to change you. But the change is not instantaneous. Not that you listen to, you know, some song and all of a sudden you're going out in the street and, you know, doing the things that the song says to do. But it works on your subconscious. And the more of this information that comes in, it eventually starts to change your character and your behavior. And for sure, it will take you away from Allah. For sure. Because if it were to able to bring you closer to Allah, then Islam would not have prohibited it. It is something which takes us away from Allah. And this is why it is fundamentally forbidden. So for a Muslim to get away from it, it means, one, getting rid of all the records, the CDs, and all this type of thing. That's the first step. Because you can't keep these things around you and say, I'm going to stop. Because anytime you feel the desire, you can easily take it and pop it into the tape recorder or whatever, and CD player, and listen to it. So you try to remove the obvious products which can keep you trapped from around yourself. And you try to listen to more Quran. Try to learn Arabic so that when you hear the Quran, it has more meaning to you. So you're not just hearing Arabic music, because sometimes people also get into the Quran like it becomes Arabic music instead. You know, you get into Abdul Basit and Husri and the different recitations, but you're getting into the music of it. You're not really getting into the Quran. So it's important that as we try to build ourselves through listening to the Quran more, that we also strive to understand Arabic to better understand what Allah is saying to us. And also, it's good to be around other people who are themselves away from this. You know, because if you hang around people who are, you know, listening to music all the time, every time you're with them, they're just, you know, the things, listening to the tape recorders or whatever, it's always around you, then it's very easy to get sucked back into it. But you need to try to develop, you know, other friendships, you know, of people who are not into it, who are trying themselves to get away from it. So together, you can help each other escape the trap. Now please clarify the proper behavior of brothers and sisters who do Islamic work together. Is it allowed for mixed group projects, like in schools? Well, the school circumstance that we're in is a circumstance where males and females are together in class anyway. So the issue of mixed or not mixed is something which is already there. This is what you're living. If you have to do an Islamic project and there are males and females involved, there is no harm in working together on it, but at the same time, one just has to be careful that the project, you know, doesn't go beyond the activities of that project into flirting and these kind of things. It's not illegitimate for you to want to get married. If your intention is marriage, then there are certain channels that can be gone through. And that we should know as young Muslims that this is the only way. If a person wants to have a relationship with a girl, then it's marriage. You know, and marriage doesn't necessarily have to be when you're 21. You know, marriage can be earlier if your families are positive. Islam encourages early marriage anyway. Other than that, if you're not thinking about marriage, then you should deal with each other where you have to in your Islamic project, you know, as you would with your own sister, you know, and not as you would with a girlfriend. So, to whatever degree it is possible that Islamic projects in the school be done, the boys doing a certain segment of it and the girls doing a certain segment of it, and avoiding the loose mixing with each other, then it is better to avoid it. But where it isn't possible, then you work together, but you work together maintaining the Islamic principles in terms of how you deal with each other, that, you know, you don't turn it into a flirting party circumstance. How do we address the issue of homosexuality to fellow Muslims and converts due to some that pity them? Well, they can be pitied, you know. People who are drug addicts, they can be pitied. We should pity them. We know they're in the wrong. What they're doing is incorrect. But we should feel sorry for them. Sorry for them in the sense that it is unfortunate that they have gone astray. If there's any way that we can guide them back to the path, we try to. Same thing with homosexuals. We can pity them. Pity them in that they have gone astray. Not pity them in the sense that, oh, what they're doing is okay and the society is hard on them. No. What they're doing is not okay. It is sick. It is a sickness. A spiritual and a mental sickness. This is the fact. And it is not something which is inborn. Like they like to try to promote now that, you know, people are born homosexual. No. People choose to be homosexual. Because if people are born homosexual, then it means that Allah has made people a certain way and then punished them for being that way. And Allah is not just. Just like Allah didn't make people, you know, fornicators, adulterers, Allah didn't make them that way. We all have different inclinations, but we all have the ability to control those inclinations and to live according to the laws that God has set. Are we accountable for our thoughts? No, we're not. Prophet ﷺ said that we are not held accountable for our thoughts as long as we don't speak on them or act on them. Is horoscopes completely forbidden? If it's regarding the character of an individual and not a future prediction, but just some coincidental aspect of character taken from the horoscope. No, horoscopes are completely forbidden. There's nothing about character and... No, because, you see, when they tell you about character, okay, you are a Taurus. It means you have this kind of character, right? Somebody else is a Cancer. They have that kind of character. And what do they do with that? They say, because you are a Taurus with this kind of character, and that person a Cancer with that kind of character, you cannot get married. You can't work with this person because you have different characters. This is nonsense. This is nonsense because they're telling you ultimately about your future. So the system, the horoscope system, is one which is rooted in fortune telling. The fact that some aspects of it may address issues of character don't change the system as being a fortune-telling system. And even the character information, which is false anyway. Just because you are born, we have 10 people born on the same day. Are you going to say they all have the same character because they're born on the same day? That's nonsense. That's total nonsense. And practice tells us this is not the case. And as I said, they use this birth date information as a basis for determining what your supposed character is, in order also to determine what your future should be. Is it permissible to wear the hairstyle in fashion, in connection to clothes fashion, like the lower half of the head to the neck is shaven, cut to about 1 to 2 millimeters in length, and the above is long? Brothers say that it is not really shaven. Well, it's true, it's not really shaven, but again, it is imitating the ways, the fashion of the disbelievers. You know, if they tell you to shave a line down the middle of your head in the end, and then there you are doing it. Today you might laugh at it, and you know, you say, ha ha ha. But tomorrow when it becomes the style, then we see you doing it, then I can say, ha ha ha. Right? You know, this is the reality, you know, that again, when we become a slave to fashion, whether it is hair fashion or clothes fashion, you know, this takes away from ourselves, it weakens us. We should only be slaves to Allah. This is what Islam means, that we are only slaves to Allah. So the things that we do, the decisions that we make, are ones based on reason and logic, and not a slavery to any fashion or ideas, especially of the disbelievers. If your family is non-practicing, how can you bring them back to be practicing? Well, the best thing, of course, is to be the best kind of Muslim that you can be. You can show them how Islam has changed your life and made you a better person. Perhaps it will cause them to reflect. You can try to bring videotapes, Islamic lectures into the home, which they may hear at different times, and which may encourage them to reflect and to change. You know, we try to bring some, through the media, bring some new input into the home that may help them, may guide them. And we can also directly advise them. But we should remember that for 13 years in Mecca, Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam invited his family, and no member of his family who was older than he was accepted Islam. So it is the nature of older people not to want to listen to younger people. Okay? This is their nature. So don't be surprised if after you've explained things in full detail, you know, all the fine points have been clearly explained to your parents or your uncles, your aunts, whatever, and you think they should be completely convinced that after all of that, they still don't agree. You know, your job is only to convey to them in the best way possible, and then you have to leave it. If they accept it, alhamdulillah. If they don't accept it, mashallah. This is the will of Allah. So, really, the best thing is to try to convey to them as much as you can through all the different means. Also, your friends who may have parents who are practicing, you try to, you know, bring the families together so that the parents who are practicing can have interaction with the parents who are not practicing. And this may be a means of conveying Islam to those parents. So we try whatever means we can, and in the end we have to be patient, leave it up to Allah. We don't give up on them, because they won't listen to us today or tomorrow or the day after. It doesn't mean that they may not listen to us at a later point in time. For myself, I accepted Islam in 1972. My parents didn't accept Islam until 1994, 22 years later. And I would talk to them about Islam through all that period. So what it means is that to say that you don't give up. As long as they're living, it's possible for them to change and to accept. So you have to constantly try to pass that information on to them. But as I said, it has to be done in the best way. You can't get upset and start shouting and, you know, become offensive, become disrespectful, because even though your parents may not be practicing Islam, they still have certain rights over you, which you should fulfill. Of course, if they ask you to do something which is haram, something which is forbidden, then you're not to obey them. You should not do it. But as long as whatever they're asking you to do is halal, then you should obey them. They are still remain your parents. Having non-Muslim friends, not necessary. Preferring them over the Muslims, is that wrong? Well, the point is, having non-Muslim friends is acceptable Islamically. It's possible to have non-Muslim friends. But Islamically speaking, one's best friend should not be a non-Muslim. One's closest friends, the ones who one relies on, etc., they should not be non-Muslims. Our close friends, our best friends, those who we depend on, etc., these should be Muslims. Is playing the piano as an instrument haram? Yes. Even if it does not keep you from doing what you must do, as in praying, yes, still haram. The piano is a haram instrument. As I said, the effect of these musical instruments is not immediate. It doesn't mean a person plays the piano today and they stop praying tomorrow. But the point is that these instruments affect the person subtly. The music affects the person subtly, affects the subconscious mind, and eventually changes the conscious mind. But it's maybe a very gradual process. And all you have to do is look at the lives of the great musicians. The corruption that is in there is clear evidence of the harm that can come from it. Taking into consideration that we do everything for Allah's sake, when we help another brother Muslim or sister Muslim or non-Muslim, sometimes we do it to please that other person. If we're doing it for the sake of Allah, and we're also doing it because it is pleasing to that person, there is no harm. Meaning, if somebody wants you to do something for them, and you do it for them in order to please them, but you're doing it remembering Allah, that what you have been asked to do is something which is acceptable Islamically, and this is something, you're doing it remembering Allah, you're doing it not in a way which goes against Islam, then you are rewarded for it. If you do it without remembering Allah, you didn't think of Allah or anything, but you just did it, it was a good thing they asked you to do, then you're not rewarded for that act as being an act of worship, but there is no sin against you if you did it to please somebody alone. Okay, inshallah, we'll stop here for the salah, and we'll continue after Salat al-Zuhr, inshallah.
I just have some announcements.
Okay. Throw up my clothes. Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalam ala Rasulil Kareem. وعلى آله وأصحابه ومن استنى بالسنة إلى يوم الدين. Question: if my family is not practicing, or in the case of the convert, parents are non-Muslims, and I'd like to be religious, am I old enough to live alone? No age given, so it's difficult to determine, are they old enough to live alone? But I don't think that we can't really set the age limit in terms, in any case, you know. If a person in their effort to practice Islam at home is under such pressure as stops them from practicing, and another family can take them in, then Islamically, it is legitimate to leave one's family and go and stay with another family. And there is no special age limit set. Of course, in this country, there may be laws which govern who can do what. So these have also to be taken into account. And one should not just automatically, simply because one's parents are not practicing or their parents are non-Muslims, one should feel automatically, well, I can't live in this circumstance, you know, because, again, you know, we still have responsibilities to parents. And we shouldn't just cast those aside simply because they're not practicing Islam or they're non-Muslims. The responsibilities are there. And as long as they are not stopping a person from practicing Islam, I mean, they're non-Islamic or whatever, as long as you are able to practice your Islam within that environment, then you shouldn't consider, you know, running away from home or leaving your home, etc. But where a circumstance is so oppressive that one is being prevented from practicing, then it's preferable to find some other family. If one is still a youth, young person, one should try to find another family which one can go and stay with. And also, the legal implications should be looked into before one makes such a step. How can one know whether or not he should get traveling privileges for prayer? Is it by measuring a distance, or as you mentioned before the prayer, by city? The traveler, when a person sets out on a journey, what is known to be a journey under normal circumstances in a given community, that gives a person the right to take the concessions which Allah has given with regards to shortening prayers, which are 4 units, to 2, and joining the Dhuhr and Asr, Maghrib and Isha. It is not really a measure of distance. There are different opinions held by scholars according to the distance and the fact that they all differ. And there are hadiths referring to different distances, but without specifying them. A number of scholars have held that it is according to intention. When a person sets out on a journey, one takes his or her toothbrush, clothes in a bag, you know, things like the things that we do for journey are well known. Because when you say a distance, 10 miles in New York City, you may go from one borough to another borough on the subway and you've traveled 10 miles. I mean, is that person considering himself or herself a traveler? No. You know, they're just going to the masjid by the subway. So it's really your intention. And the principle of shortening prayer and joining it comes into effect when one leaves the outskirts of the city. Once you're still inside of the city, then you don't start to shorten and join before setting off your journey. Once you have left the outskirts of the city, then you may now shorten and join prayers. If God knows a person is going to hell or heaven, what is the purpose of making that person live on earth? Actually, I wrote a book called The Purpose of Creation, and this is explained in extensive detail in it. I can just say briefly that it's not a question of if God knows who is going to heaven and hell. God knows who is going to heaven and hell. But we live out the life on earth so that on the day of judgment, no one who is going to hell will feel that they were dealt with unjustly. This is a manifestation of Allah's attribute of justice. Because if Allah created us and put us in paradise, no one will argue with Allah why He put us in paradise. But everyone who is put in hell would question, would argue, why are we being put in hell? And if Allah said to us, well, you would have done this and you would have done that, we would say, no, we wouldn't. Why would anybody want to do that and end up in hell? If we know there's a heaven and a hell, sure, we'll do the things that will take us to heaven. So Allah allows us to live out our lives. So when we stand before Him on the day of judgment, no one will be arguing with Allah, why is He putting them in hell? Everyone will know that they're going to hell because they put themselves in hell. They have done the deeds, they have chosen the deeds that take them to hell instead of the deeds that take them to paradise. And for those who are going to heaven, when they live out this life and go to heaven, ultimately, by the grace of Allah, this makes them even more thankful, because they know, in terms of the deeds that they did in this life, that were Allah to hold them to account, deed for deed, like one good deed against one evil deed, then no one would have entered paradise. That it is only by the grace of Allah that Allah multiplies our good deeds 10 times and more, that our good deeds erase our evil deeds. So we end up in paradise by the mercy and grace of Allah. Because men and women, according to the hadith of the Prophet ﷺ, are not to dress similarly, then is it wrong for a woman to wear pants? Many people also say that women wearing pants show the shape of their legs. Is this true? Well, I think if women are wearing pants, you know, whether it shows the shape of their legs or not, this is quite obvious. If the pants are tight enough, then the legs will show. If the pants are so loose as not to show the shape of the legs, then such pants would be legitimate. So the issue is not necessarily wearing of pants or not wearing of pants, but one, whether the pants expose their aura, and two, if the pants are in a design which are traditionally males, then this is also not permissible in that they are dressing like males. However, having said that, this is in a public circumstance, in the privacy of a person's home, between a husband and wife, etc. You know, these don't necessarily, these are not applicable, in the sense that if a woman was around the same size as her husband and she decides to wear his pants in his home, there is no harm. Islam doesn't say it's forbidden for her to wear his pants, right? Of course, for him to put on her dress, you know, because women wear pants, you know, traditionally, him putting on her dress or starting to put on her clothes, I mean, it does say, Islam would say something. Because men and women, is it acceptable for Muslim brothers and sisters in university, MSA, to work together in planning, organizing activities such as Islamic Awareness Week? I think we answered this question in terms of the etiquette, etc. We said the best thing is that there be a committee for the brothers, a committee for the sisters, that they organize amongst themselves separately. And where they need to cooperate, then the person who's representative of the brothers communicates with the representative of the sisters to that degree. And where the project is presented and some aspect has to be presented by the sisters, then that aspect should be separate as much as possible from that of the brothers. Is smoking considered intoxication? If yes, why? Smoking is haram. Not necessarily because it's considered intoxication, and it is considered a form of intoxication, but fundamentally it is haram because of the fact that one who takes it is engaging in an act of suicide. Suicide is defined as taking some substance which one knows will kill the person, has the ability to kill them. Whether the person takes it and it doesn't kill them or not, you know, this is not the issue. The issue is that if you know that this glass of poison can kill you, for you to take it is an act of suicide. Whether you take it in small amounts, a little bit every week, and at the end of the year you drop dead because it has accumulated its effects in your system, or you take it as one full glass and one instant and you die from it, it's all suicide. And smoking, we should understand that smoking, though there was a ruling that smoking initially was makruh by some of the scholars when the issue of smoking reached the Turkish state, the Ottoman Empire, back in the 15th century, when it reached there, 16th century, the scholars ruled it to be makruh based on certain principles, because we have to understand that the issue of what is makruh and what is haram is not an arbitrary decision that, you know, I feel it's makruh, so it's makruh, or you feel it's haram, so it's haram. No. It is based on law, Islamic law, and there are principles of Islamic law which govern it. As such, it's preferable that one, to properly understand this, should get some grounding in Islamic law if they have doubts about it. Inshallah, in the coming sessions, we will look at the issues, the basic fundamental issues of Islamic law with regards to how things are determined to be haram, how they're determined to be, you know, makruh, and etc., etc. We'll be looking at that in the next couple of days in our last sessions on fiqh. We'll look at it in some detail. But for now, it's enough to say that when the scholars looked at the issue of actually those brothers that have a clear cough, you know, that are, you know, coughing, and we know that this coughing does spread germs, It would be better for you to sit at the back so to minimize, you know, the contagion, you know, and also to minimize the disturbance. Shukran. The issue of smoking being haram, as I said, is based on the fact. Originally, the scholars ruled it to be makruh because when they analyzed the effects of smoking on the individual back in the 16th century, the only effect that they could find was that it caused bad breath. The smoker's breath is well known. They have all these products on the market that you spray in your mouth as a smoker to minimize that bad breath. So that's all they could see from it, bad breath. So they then went back to the Sharia to look and see what is the ruling in Sharia, in Revelation, from Quran or from Sunnah, which addresses things which cause bad breath. When they went into the Sharia, what they found was Prophet Muhammad ﷺ had said, those people who eat raw onions and garlic do not come to our masjids. Pray at home. Don't come and pray in the masjid. Why? Because of course, in the end of our prayers, we turn to each other saying, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. And a person who's been chewing raw garlic, you know, it's very offensive. It would make prayer very uncomfortable for people. So, people were told to stay home, meaning they're going to miss the reward of 27 times increased prayer. It's not that it's haram, because Prophet ﷺ didn't say your prayer is invalid. Because if he said prayer is invalid, then it meant eating onions and garlic is haram. But he said you pray at home, meaning that you pray at home, you don't get the additional reward of praying in the masjid. So it means makruh, anything which will stop you from getting the maximum reward for different acts will be classified as makruh. So based on that principle, they made the ruling that smoking was makruh. Although some scholars, even from that time, ruled that it was haram. There were some. But the majority held it was makruh. However, in the late 70s, 79, 80, when the Surgeon General of the United States, after a number of years of research on smoking, announced that it has now been conclusively proven that smoking causes cancer, and we know that cancer causes death, now the Islamic ruling had to change. Scholars now had to go and look at smoking from a different perspective, that smoking causes cancer, cancer causes death. This now is under the category of things which cause death, and we know Allah said in the Quran, وَلَا تُلْقُوا بِأَيْدِيكُمْ إِلَى التَّهْلُكَةِ. Don't throw yourselves into destruction. It's forbidden to kill yourself. Prophet Muhammad ﷺ said, whoever kills himself in this life will find himself in the next life killing himself over and over and over again. So, suicide is haram. Why are you putting it in front of others? More important. Suicide fundamentally is haram. Therefore, the scholars then ruled that smoking is haram from the point of view of it being an act of suicide. It is also, as the person asked, an intoxicant from the point of view that the term for intoxicant in Arabic is khamar. And Omar radiallahu anhu said, al-khamar ma yukhamiru al-aql. Khamar is whatever veils the mind, which covers the functions of some of the mind. You know how your mind functions, some distortion has taken place. So anything which will veil that functioning is classified as khamar. And we know, a person, when they first smoke, if they took an unfiltered cigarette, well, this is the real cigarette now, as it is, unfiltered, and smoked it, smoked a whole cigarette, or smoked a pack of cigarettes, they would be in such a state we would have to classify them as intoxicated. You know, commonly police, in the summer when the roads are dry, if they want to quickly test if you're intoxicated before they use breathalyzers, they used to take the chalk and draw a line on the pavement and tell you to walk that line. That is, put one foot after the other on the line. Now, if they see you're putting one foot over here and the other foot over here, and then they classify you as intoxicated and take you away. And for sure, a person who smokes, the very first time they smoke, they did that, they would not be able to walk that line. Smoking and the ability to smoke is something that you develop gradually. When you first start to smoke, nobody takes the first cigarette and goes, no way. You did that, you'd be coughing, your head would be spinning. No, what you do is you take a little bit, you know, or you start with menthols, you know, mentholated cigarettes with the big filters, and you work your way up, you know, until you become, you know, a Philip Morris man, you know, or a Camel's man, whatever. You know, this is what you do. So what happens, because what happens when you inhale, your system is rejecting this. Your lungs are fighting against it. That's what's causing you to cough, everything else. But what happens is that by taking it gradually, you see, you numb the nerve endings, etc., inside of your lungs. You beat them into submission so that then you can take your full blast and nothing happens. Smoking is also forbidden from the point of view of it being squandering. Because if a person spends, what is the average cost of a pack of cigarettes?
I don't know.
How much is the average pack of cigarettes cost? Huh? $3. Okay, $3. If we multiply, if a person smokes, a good smoker, he's smoking at least two packs a day. Right? He's a good smoker. Huh? Benefiting the cigarette companies. Huh? Two packs a day, that's $6 a day. Multiply that times 365. What do we get? Who's the mathematician in here? And what's the number? Huh? 830. Now you better go back to mathematics class. 6 times 365. No. Well, it's over 2,000. Some $2,000+. The point is that if you saw somebody, give up. Here. If you were to take $2,000. If you saw somebody take $2,000 bills, you know, $100. Or whatever, roll them up into 2,000 and then light it up. What would you say about this person? This man is mad. Take that money away from him. He doesn't know how to use his money. You know? This is what you would say. But in fact, when a person is smoking, that's what he's doing. He's burning up $2,000 a year. Just destruction, because it's of no benefit to the body. It's just pure wastage. And Allah says in the Quran, إِلَّا الْمُبَذِّرِينَ كَانُوا إِخْوَانَ الشَّيَاطِينَ. The squandering, the spendthrift, those who waste, are among the brethren of the devils. وَكَانَ الشَّيْطَانُ لِرَبِّهِ كَفُورًا. And Satan was a disbeliever in his Lord. So, smoking is forbidden on many counts. Included also is the count that it harms your brother Muslim. Because the scientists tell us, doctors tell us, that secondary smoke, the smoke which is coming off the end of the cigarette, is much more harmful than the smoke which you're taking in, which has been inhaled, which is through a filter. So that secondary smoke which is coming, people who live around you, who are in contact with you, they are being harmed by it. And Prophet Muhammad ﷺ said, "Al-Muslim man salim al-Muslimuna min lisanihi wa yadi." That the Muslim, a true Muslim, is one from whom the other Muslims is safe from the actions of his tongue and his hand. So, for one to be smoking and deliberately harming other Muslims, this of course is classified as haram. So it's haram from many, many counts. So those of you who are smoking, please beware that what you're doing is a major sin. It is on a similar level to taking alcohol, smoking marijuana, you know. Though the effects of alcohol and marijuana may be more obvious, and we can say this is haram, the smoking of cigarettes, of tobacco, is equally haram. It is an equal major sin. And the only way for you to free yourself from this is to turn back to Allah in repentance for the sin that you are involved in, and make a commitment to Allah to stop and stop. Not gradually, because you try to do it gradually, it's very easy for you to fall back again. How many people have been gradually quitting for the last 5-10 years? You know, you want to do it. It's an issue of mind over matter. You are the controller of your own body. If you want to do it, you can do it. We have a calculation of the exact amount of a two pack a day habit is $2,190. Thank you. Anyway, the point is that it is something that we should feel inside our hearts is wrong. If you don't feel that it is wrong, You have heard it is haram. The evidence is all in front of you. If you don't feel that there's something wrong with you, you don't feel bad about it, then this is telling you the state of your faith. This is telling you the state of your iman. When that which is haram, that which is hated by Allah, is pleasing to you, you still enjoy it, you don't feel bad about it, then it means that your iman is on the lowest of levels, no matter what you're doing. No matter what you're doing in terms of other actions, etc., etc. When you love and don't feel remorse, don't feel bad about doing the things which are displeasing to Allah, then it means that your faith is in really rough shape. In Islam, the Quran says Adam was the first man, but archaeologists have found skeletons of humans dating before Adam. Please comment on this. Who said they found those dating before Adam? This is the point. Who says when Adam was created? So we can say these skeletons we're finding was before Adam. You know, let's not make these assumptions. This is a wrong assumption in the first place. Right? Secondly, these skeletons they're finding, who says that they were humans? You said they're skeletons of humans. Who said they were humans? They said they're humans. Does that make them humans? No. These skeletons that are being found, right? How do we know that they're humans? Yes, they will give us a picture of what this guy looked like, even to the color of his eyes. You know? And from two teeth they found, right? And they give you the whole shape of the body, how he walked, everything from two teeth, right? Be careful. You know, what is being presented to us as science, I mean, how many times? Just read about the Piltdown man. Read about the Piltdown man. And you'll see some of the hoaxes of science. Read about the Nebraska man. You know, as you have the Neanderthal man, you also have the Nebraska man. But Nebraska man was based on a single tooth. They had a whole individual, what he looked like and everything, and then some years later they discovered it was the tooth of an extinct pig. It wasn't even human. Okay? So, before we start to jump to conclusions about these bones that they find, you know, and what these bones mean, or whether they were human or not, you know, Allah knows ultimately the truth of the matter, but we have apes around here, around living in our own time, and these apes, some of them, will hunt together. See, because they try to say, well, how do we know what is a human from what is not a human? You know, that the human beings, they have this sense of intelligence, that they will do things together, they make tools and all this kind of thing. This is not to say that they were not apes of an earlier period of time that made crude tools. It's quite possible. It's quite possible. But to say that we have skeletons of humans before Adam, this is an incorrect statement. What we know is that when Allah created Adam, when Allah created man, he was a man. He was a man from the very beginning. He was not a half man, half ape, cousin to the ape. He was a man. Having all of the basic faculties of the human being, he had the very first man whom Allah created. And we see among human beings much variation. And these theories that they have about the early men, etc., these theories are changing. Changing a lot. Now, I read in Time magazine, they had found some skeletons, some skull bones and things of the Java man, who was supposed to be from another line that ended before the Homo sapiens appeared, who was supposed to be modern man. But then they found that these new findings, that these skulls were in a strata of earth which had other bones of people of in the same level of the Homo sapiens. So now, you know, this has caused a big stir amongst them, that in fact these people didn't really die out as they thought, but they were living alongside the Homo sapiens. You know, their theories are changing all the time. So let us not be fooled thinking that what we have received from revelation has been disproven by science. Because what we have in our hands is a lot of theories, some bones, and the fact of the matter, we still don't know. If smoking is haram, wouldn't it also be haram to eat oily foods, which may cause heart attacks? Sounds like a die-hard smoker who doesn't want to give up, right? He's got to find an excuse for himself, right? He's going to go down in flames. Okay, the point is, any food taken to excess can be harmful. Water taken to excess can kill you. If you drink enough water, you can drink enough water until the pH balance in your system changes and you die. Water. So the issue is not about oily foods can cause heart attacks. No. Oily foods in and of themselves don't cause heart attacks. If people eat excesses of oily foods, then it can cause heart attacks. Depending on their lifestyle. If they have very active lifestyles where, you know, like in many of the people in the third world where they're, you know, working and, you know, from morning till night, they can eat all, no end of oily foods. It doesn't affect them. But when you're living a sedentary lifestyle where you're the couch potato, you know, watching television from, you know, evening until the next morning, and your lifestyle is just, you get in your car, you just sit in front of the television, then of course oily foods, you know, many other foods can harm you in excess. Which is much different from smoking. Smoking, for one, is not a food. There is no benefit from smoking, period. So you can't compare smoking to food. For example, sugar. Sugar is halal. It is permissible. But if you, as a diabetic, were informed that if you take sugar, it will make you comatose and die, then sugar for you becomes haram. So where the medical profession identifies a point of harm for you as an individual, then this can be that substance which will cause harm to you at beyond that point becomes haram for you to take this deliberately. However, in the case of smoking, smoking is a causer of cancer for people in general. It is something haram. It is haram because fundamentally it is not beneficial for you. It is harmful to you and known to kill. So we don't compare smoking to other foods. Similarly, some may say, well, there are people who smoke all their lives and they live to 110 years old. You know, we have some people, they had a woman there in China, she's about 115 years old. She has a cigar every day. You know, I said, look at her. She didn't die. This is a sign from Allah that ultimately death is in Allah's hands. We don't decide whether we do something or not do it on the basis of exceptions to the rule. You know? You don't jump out of an airplane without a parachute and say, Insha'Allah, I will survive. No, there are people who have, you know, gone out of the airplanes, their parachutes didn't work, and they survived from 50,000 feet. Yes, it happens. But 99% of those who come out at 50,000 feet die. They're splattered on the ground. They have to scrape them up afterwards. Okay? So on that basis, for you to say, I'm trusting in Allah, and jumping out the airplane without your parachute, this is suicide. Similarly to smoking, 99% of those people who are smoking die. Get cancer, rots part of their bodies, and they die from it. So for you to say, well, based on that 1% who doesn't die from it, I'm smoking and trusting in Allah, that is suicide. Well, we have 5 minutes and 500 questions. What can we do here? Sleeping on your stomach. Yeah, don't sleep on your stomach. Putting up Quranic ayahs on the wall in your home. It's permissible, as long as one doesn't believe that they're going to protect them from harm or bring good for them. If putting up the ayah on the wall, you're believing it's going to bring good luck to your home, then you're in trouble. Take it down. If a girl has her period, can she go to the mosque if there's a speech like today, for instance? Well, this is not a mosque. This is a musalla. So it's permissible for her to come here and listen. But to a mosque, for her to come and sit in a mosque, it is not permissible. She can come in to get something and leave, but to come and stay in it, no. But it's a musalla. Musalla means it's a place which is temporarily designated for prayer. It is not a mosque. Prayer is established here 5 times a day. And it is owned by the Muslim community. This is a rented location which the owner can say tomorrow, Ma'a Salama, and we all have to pack up and leave. Is there a particular time of night and day a Muslim guy or girl should be at home by?
There is hadith where Prophet ﷺ said that parents should bring their children
in the homes at Maghrib, the time of Maghrib, because at this time the evil forces become very active. They come out in the society, become active, you know, and after the passing of the time of Maghrib, then they can let them go again. So as a general practice, it would be preferable that Muslims not be out on their own, especially, you know, around this time. And in terms of time after that, it depends on the family, it depends on the reason why the person is out, etc. Some people say you can only shorten your prayers for 3 nights, others say 15 days. Well, as long as one is on a journey, one is permitted to shorten the prayer. This is based on the practice of the Sahaba. Anas ibn Malik was in Syria for 2 years, during which he continued to shorten his prayers.
I borrowed amount from the bank for school, but now I'm studying part-time working. At the same time, I can't pay all of it at once because I don't have the amount, but I'll be paying it little by little. At the same time, I'll be paying interest. I think this is all I can do. What would you suggest? Though I know I will never borrow again. Well, of course, paying interest is haram. Signing that contract of interest was in itself haram. And we should ask Allah's forgiveness if we have ended up in situations like that. Try to clear our debts as quickly as possible and then not return to it.
What about brothers whose feet stink? Should they rather stay at home too?
Yes. Many people say that wearing the face veil is mandatory. Why do they say this? Is it true?
There is evidence that the women in the time of Prophet ﷺ also covered their faces. And on the basis of this and other evidences, some scholars have taken the position that it's compulsory. But the majority of scholars hold that it is recommended and up to the woman to choose herself.
In the ayah that says, tell your wives, your daughters, the believing women to cast their outer garments, does this mean we should wear a jilbab over our loose clothing?
Yes, a jilbab should be worn. Outer garment is part of proper Islamic dress. That if a person wears a dress which is so loose that it may be looked at as an outer garment, then this can stand in its place. As long as it is not, you know, flowery and colorful and attractive in and of itself, like the way her dress, because that would be her finery, which is supposed to be covered. As Allah said in the other verse about putting on the khimar and putting it over their bosom, and that nothing should be seen of their finery except that which must be. So it shouldn't be in their clothes. If one doesn't have wudu, is he or she allowed to hold, touch, read the Quran? Yes, it is permissible, but preferable that one have wudu. When you come to the masjid for Salatul Jummah, do you have to pray 4 rakah sunnah and your 2 rakah for coming to the masjid? What is required of you when you come into the masjid, whether for Jummah or any other time, is 2 rakah before sitting down. Before sitting down in the masjid, it is required that you pray 2 rakah. Beyond that, Prophet ﷺ, you know, had made recommendations specifically for Jummah. When a person comes to the masjid early and they pray whatever Allah has written for them to pray, then there they get certain rewards. You know, rewards are increased. So there is no set amount that one may pray coming before Jummah. Are autopsies haram, even if done for the purpose of medical research? Autopsy may be permissible where there is a necessity, where there is doubt, you know, that the person has been murdered, whatever, in order to determine the causes of the person's death, where there is doubt, it is permissible. But where it is for experimentation purposes, then Islamically speaking, you know, this may be done with animals, or it may be done with the bodies of non-Muslims. And there are many available on the market. What is better for the woman, praying at home or in the mosque? Where do we get hasanat? What about Jummah prayers? Is it mandatory for women to come, or is it better to pray at home? It's better for women to pray in their home, but it's permissible for them to pray in the masjid. They are rewarded in praying in the masjid, they are rewarded in praying at home. The reward they get in the home will be the same as they would have gotten if they came to the masjid. I mean, this is a concession for women because the basic location for them is the home. Are you allowed to bring a non-Muslim to the masjid? Yes, you are. It's permissible. In Prophet's time, non-Muslims came, met him in the masjid. Even prisoners of war, non-Muslims, were tied to the pillars of the masjid. What is the point of view about dinosaurs? They did exist. About the different forms of dhikr, actually time is up. If one starts his mandatory prayers after the age of puberty, what must one do? Meaning I guess started late. If one didn't start at the time that they should have, I mean, it becomes compulsory once you reach puberty, but actually one should be praying even before that. It's very important for parents, you know, that children are taught, as Prophet ﷺ said, they should be taught prayer at the age of 7 and spanked for it by the age of 10. So by the time they reach puberty, this is a part of their basic lifestyle. But if somebody, for whatever reason, didn't start their prayers when they reached puberty and later on started, they should ask Allah's forgiveness for what came before and try not to avoid or neglect their prayers in the future. Okay, there's another question regarding Azkar. I think it's a bit long, so we'll leave it to the end of the session tonight at 6:30 or 6 o'clock when we look at questions for the day, inshallah. Subhanakallahumma wa bihamdika. Ashhadu an la ilaha illa anta. Astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk.